Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Imagine a world in which our own bodies are programmed to kill cancer cells, genetic diseases are treated before birth, crops are resistant to pests and climate change, and mosquitoes no longer transmit infectious diseases. With the advent of a new tool called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, these scenarios are no longer hypothetical. They're possible today. CRISPR does what is called gene editing. Gene editing allows scientists to change the genetic material of any living organism. While CRISPR was preceded by other gene editing tools, it is much simpler, more efficient, and specific than its predecessors. Quite simply, it is a game changer. It may have an impact on fields as diverse as genetics, infectious disease, nutrition, agriculture, pharmacology, climate change, and even art. And it's about to get easier to use. In February, the National Academy of Sciences published a statement suggesting that they may make it easier to use gene editing to treat or prevent serious conditions in human embryos. And just last week, an advisory panel of scientists recommended that the FDA allow the editing of cancer DNA, heralding a significant new approach in the treatment of cancer. However, despite the exciting potential of this technology, serious questions and controversies remain. So tonight we ask, where and how is the CRISPR gene editing technology being used, and what is its potential? What are the concerns and controversies surrounding this new gene editing technique? How can this technology be equitably distributed and effectively regulated? And finally, what role do we, the public, play in this debate? Joining me by phone is Dr. Samuel H. Sternberg, a biochemist and the author of numerous high-profile scientific publications on CRISPR technology. He's also the co-author of A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution with Jennifer Doudna. Sam will start his own laboratory at Columbia University in 2018. Welcome, and congratulations on your new position, Sam.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you today.
Glad you can join us. Also joining me by phone is Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, the Executive Director at the Center for Genetics and Society, a Berkeley-based social justice organization that works to ensure an equitable future in which human genetic and assisted reproductive technologies benefit the common good. She speaks and writes widely on human biotechnologies, focusing on their social justice, equity, human rights, and public interest implications. Welcome, Marcy.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
Glad you could join us as well. And finally, we're joined by Hank Greeley, the director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at the Stanford School of Medicine and the chair of the steering committee of the Center for Biomedical Ethics. Mr. Greeley specializes in the ethical, legal, and social implications of new biomedical technologies, particularly those related to neuroscience, genetics, or stem cell research. He frequently serves as an advisor on California national and international policy issues, and he's the author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. Welcome, Hank.
Thanks. Good evening. Glad to be here.
Good evening to you. And we invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on kalw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. And we'll open the phone lines in just about 20 minutes, so feel free to send in those questions now online. So, Dr. Sternberg, let me start with you. I'm assuming many of our listeners have possibly never heard of CRISPR or Cas9. So I'm wondering if you could just explain in a very basic way, how does CRISPR-Cas9 work, and why should the public be following this technology?
Sure. First of all, the origin of the itself, it's kind of this funky acronym that comes from clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. That probably doesn't say much by itself. Long story short, this was discovered in bacteria, and it basically functions like a pair of molecular scissors. So bacteria is a way to fend off viral infection, but researchers are now repurposing the molecular components to target specific DNA sequences for precise edits in many other cell types. So you can take that Cas9 protein, you can take a molecule of RNA or ribonucleic acid, and then you can deliver those into human cells or plant cells, animal cells, and target very specific DNA sequences to be cut by the molecular scissors and ultimately repeat and bias. And so earlier technologies, it just makes this process of gene editing much more facile, expensive, than it really ever was before.
Mm-hmm. And how is this technology different or better than the former gene editing techniques?
Yeah, so that gets down to the molecular components that are involved. Turns out RNA is, you can think of RNA as being like DNA, molecular cutting. And scientists understand in great detail how RNA and DNA can interact. And so if you have a particular gene or DNA sequence that you'd like to edit with CRISPR, it's really as simple as taking the letters of DNA and transforming those into letters of RNA. It's almost the exact same four letters. And then those two just make a perfect match inside of the cell. The earlier technologies required extensive engineering of protein molecules, which sounds easy, but it turns out to be extremely laborious. And also the success rate can be very low. With CRISPR, you can kind of design new RNA molecules within minutes, and you can prepare those reagents in the laboratory and actually run the gene editing experiment really in just a matter of days. So it's really condensed what used to be a months-long process into something that can be done within a week or so.
And so it does sound very technical, and I'm wondering if you could put this into, although of course you did a nice job explaining it, so I don't mean to say that we couldn't follow it, but for those who are listening who are kind of curious, what does this really mean for me, can you give me examples of how this might play out, say, with a human embryo?
Well, let me give you an example from culture. This is something that scientists are studying all the time in the laboratory. So you can take cultured cells from a diseased patient, let's say blood stem cells from someone that suffers from sickle cell disease. So we know exactly what mutation causes this disease. And with CRISPR, you can literally target the diseased gene, the mutated gene, in such a way that mutation can be reversed at the DNA level so that the source of that disease is literally eradicated in the genome. And because of this program at CRISPR, if we have a different disease and we know what letters of DNA are mutated to cause the disease, you can reprogram CRISPR to target those letters instead or those genes instead. And so kind of on another analogy I would give is kind of like find and replace, like you might do in Microsoft Word or Google Docs. CRISPR really allows you to go into the genome and find specific letters or misspelled letters and then replace those with a new sequence you might want to swap in instead. And I'm oversimplifying a little bit. It's not quite that easy, but conceptually, that's really what CRISPR gives us the power to now do.
And Hank Greeley, I wanted to go to you to ask you, in terms of the non-human uses of this on plants or bacteria, for example, or animals, what are some of the issues that might arise from using this technology? I mean, what does this mean for our everyday life, and what are some of the risks associated with it?
Sure, happy to talk about that. But first, let me give your listeners an analogy that I think may help in understanding why CRISPR is such a big deal. I think it's like the Model T Ford. Before the Model T, there were cars for 20 or 30 years. There were even a few thousand cars in California, but they were really expensive. They broke down all the time. You had to be rich to have one. Once you had the Model T, anybody could own one. Pretty soon, everybody did. And California and the world changed utterly, in ways that were good and in ways that were bad. CRISPR is that kind of transformation. It's not that it lets us do something we could never do before, but it lets almost anybody do it quickly, accurately, cheaply, in ways that are going to be transformative. I think the non-human uses have not gotten enough attention. I think they are the immediate concern. You know, we care a lot about humans, and if you're going to do something to try to affect human babies, we're going to pay a lot of attention to how safe it is. The FDA is going to be involved. Doctors have to be involved. Tort lawyers may be involved. That's a big burden for people to take on before they do something with people. If you've got a system that harms half of the mosquito babies you make, the only complaint people will make is you only harmed half of the mosquito babies. And we don't care nearly as much, and the regulations aren't nearly as stringent or important with non-humans. I think we are already beginning to see in various parts of the world people playing around with CRISPR to make goats with longer hair, to make dogs with stronger bones, to make miniature pigs, as well as to make lots of crops that will be useful. I think the agricultural uses are going to be predominant, but we'll also see it used in wild nature, things like changing mosquitoes so they can't give humans malaria, or changing chestnut trees, which are almost extinct as adults in the United States because of a virus, a fungus from Asia, changing those to resist that fungus. We're going to use it for that. We're going to use it to make pets. We're going to use it to make blue roses. We're going to use it to make unicorns, and artists are going to use it to make mind-blowing art. So I think this is really where we need to concentrate right now, because our regulatory structure isn't ready for it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. You mentioned that this is being experimented with in other parts of the world. What is the current regulatory landscape for this, for using this technology?
Well, if you look around the world, the regulatory landscape varies enormously, from no GM life to no rules at all. In the United States, the regulatory landscape derives from what's called the Coordinated Framework, which was put together in the Reagan administration in 1985 and 86, and took existing laws and said, okay, FDA, you've got this piece, USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, you've got this piece, EPA, you've got that piece, but they're using statutes that don't really have anything to do with this, and they're stretching them broadly. So, for example, if you make a mosquito that's resistant to malaria, the gene change that you put in the mosquito is, according to the FDA, regulated as an animal drug, as if it's a pill that you're giving your dog or your cat. It's kind of crazy, and it's got holes. So last year, somebody brought a mushroom that had been changed so that it could not, when it's cut, turn brown. So these are the little white button mushrooms. Normally you cut them, and in a few hours, instead of white, the cut part is brown. They took out a gene, so it no longer does that. They went to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which generally regulates genetically modified crops, and agriculture said, well, we don't have regulatory authority over this, because we only have authority when you move a gene from one species to another. You didn't move any genes for this, and so therefore, it's unregulated.
And so what's the downside of this current, I mean, of not having it regulated? What are some of the risks that the public should be aware of?
So I don't think there's a downside to white button mushrooms that don't turn brown, although I still would like to have somebody take a look at it before it gets widely commercialized. But you could worry about people making changes and introducing them into the environment and it turning into a pest, like starlings, which were brought to North America by a Shakespeare fancier, or kudzu, which has taken over large chunks of the Southeast. These invasive, in a sense, the genetically modified plants, animals, and microbes could be invasive species that could harm the environment. They could be vectors for disease that, you know, you fix the mosquito so it doesn't transmit malaria, but maybe now it transmits something else. They could be, and this is kind of the one that really is scariest, they could be bioweapons.
Mm-hmm. Well, we definitely we want to get into the bioterrorist concern as well. But I did want to be able to involve Dr. Darnovsky in this discussion. Dr. Darnovsky, I would be interested to hear your take on what you see with CRISPR in terms of the issues arising, particularly when it's used or applied for humans. What are some of the concerns that you think the public should be made aware of?
Sure. Yeah, that's the focus of my organization, the Center for Genetics and Society, is genetic modification in human beings. And I think that actually does deserve a lot of attention, although certainly reshaping all of the natural world and ecosystems also deserves attention. But in terms of human beings, a very key distinction that is typically made in these conversations and that really needs to be made is between using gene editing tools or other genetic modification tools, for that matter, to alter the cells and tissues of an existing person. That's something typically you would do if you're trying to cure a disease, like sickle cell, I think Sam mentioned. And sometimes that's called somatic genetic modification, because the soma, or the body cells, in distinction to that, is what is sometimes called germline genetic modification. And germline doesn't have anything to do with germs. It's named for sperm and eggs, which are the gametes, or germ cells. And genetic modifications to those cells or to an early stage embryo would be reflected in every cell in the resulting child, if that child was successfully brought to term, and that then would be passed down to all future generations. So this is quite a big deal for a number of reasons. One is because the human organism, and especially going through all these developmental complexities that an embryo does, this is very, very complicated system. And just like you don't know what's going to happen if you take one kind of mosquito out of an ecosystem, scientists really don't know always what's going to happen when you make one little genetic change in an early embryo. So the safety of using gene editing for germline modification, that is, you know, to control the genes and the traits of a future child and future generations, that safety is, we're far from knowing that it's safe enough. And most people and most scientists would agree that it would be irresponsible to try to do that right now.
Well, it sounds like the plot of a kind of a stereotypical science fiction novel where you have the well-intentioned scientist, but then the unintended consequence happens, and we don't necessarily know what we're opening up. So,
well, you know, that's a really good point, because we used to think of this as science fiction. We used to think of it as a far-off hypothetical. But now I think it's really not that at all. It's really an urgent matter of social justice.
And how close are we to this really being used in, beyond just sort of testing it in a laboratory, where are we in terms of deployment?
Well, you know, right now, no responsible scientist or doctor would try to do it, but it is really time to think this through and to have wide-ranging conversations, because this has the potential to really reshape not just individuals, but whole societies. Because if we were to use gene editing to try to control the traits of our children and give them genetic advantages, you know, the latest upgrade, we would quickly find ourselves, I think it's very likely, in a world where wealthy parents who could afford to do this would be engineering the traits of their offspring so that they would have increased advantages. And whether or not they really were smarter or stronger or whatever, if they were perceived to be that way, we could really find ourselves bumping up the already horrible kinds of social inequalities and stratification and discrimination that we live with to an entirely new level. So that's why I say it's an urgent social justice concern.
So I think there's a lot of issues to explore there, but I wanted to pick up on something you say and actually give Sam Sternberg a chance to respond. You talked a bit about the somatic cells, the body cells from soma versus germline modifications. Sam Sternberg, can you explain a little bit about why germline gene editing is more controversial than somatic cell genomic editing, and maybe a little bit more about what the difference is and the potential upsides of the two might be?
Yeah, I think Marcy gave a great explanation. The big difference is that somatic gene editing would affect the patient, him or herself, whereas germline gene editing would introduce changes that would be lasting, that would not only affect the individual or the future individual in the case of an embryo, but all of his or her descendants. So that's kind of the big distinction between those two. To come back to one of your earlier questions about where are we right now, I should point out that in terms of experiments in the laboratory, there have actually now been, I think, 3 published research articles where scientists in China, as it turns out, introduced CRISPR into human embryos. The first 2 of these studies used non-viable embryos that were otherwise going to be discarded in the clinic. But the most recent article from this year did use viable embryos. Now, as Marcy pointed out, these weren't actually implanted in any female, so they were never intended to establish pregnancies with. But the fact of the matter is, you know, I think there was a lot of concern within the scientific community and well outside that community that some scientists were really pushing forward before we and others felt like this discussion was really happening out in the open. And so I think, you know, that's the reality, is that the experimental technique to introduce CRISPR into embryos is no longer that challenging. There are, of course, questions of safety. I mean, these are huge questions about safety and efficiency and if it's really effective enough. But the manipulations themselves at this point are rather trivial. I mean, the exact same procedures have already been used dozens of times in mice embryos and also in monkey embryos. And so, in that sense, human embryos are not so different. And that's the real concern here, is that the technology is no longer limiting. And so it's the question of, well, we're no longer in the realm of science fiction. What do we now do with this new capability?
Mm-hmm. So things are happening in the lab as we speak. This is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing social, ethical, and regulatory implications of the CRISPR gene editing technology. We're joined on the phone by Dr. Samuel H. Sternberg. You just heard from him, biochemist and the co-author of A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution. Also joined by Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, Executive Director at the Center for Genetics and Society, based Christmas Cross the Bay in Berkeley, and by Hank Greeley, the Director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at the Stanford School of Medicine and the author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. We want to go ahead and open the phone lines now and invite you to call in with your questions or comments. So we want to know, what are your thoughts about genetically modified organisms? Are you more concerned about the process or product? Will the power to edit germline cells lead to a new eugenics movement and result in widening social inequality and discrimination, or will we see a significant improvement in human health and well-being? Would you be amenable to treating disease with gene editing or change the genetic material of your progeny? The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on kalw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. Well, Hank Greeley, we were just discussing the state of deployment of these technologies, and I'm curious to ask you, you talked a bit about the regulatory landscape, but what exactly is preventing someone, let's say these folks in China and the lab that Sam just mentioned, what's preventing them from going to the next step at this point? I mean, are there any laws or anything else, sort of logistically, that's preventing this from going forward?
So with respect to modifying human embryos, first, you would be criminally reckless to try this with babies at this point. I can't stress how much more we care about the safety of baby humans than we do about the safety of baby mice. It may work with mice, but before you try this with humans, you really need to have good evidence that it's going to be safe, and we're not even close to that. Different countries have different laws on this. Many countries have banned any sort of germline human genome intervention. The United States doesn't have a ban on it, but in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, regulates it, and it's illegal to try this without FDA approval. And I am quite confident the FDA is not going to be approving it anytime soon, certainly not without extremely good evidence of safety. In fact, right now, Congress has banned, as part of a one-year appropriations amendment, FDA from even considering any applications to try human genome modification. So right now, at least in the United States and in many other countries, it's illegal. The longer-run issues are interesting. On Valentine's Day of this year, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences put out a report about human gene editing, and its report said, among other things, that germline modification for purposes of treating diseases that were well understood, that were serious, and for which there was no other modification, should get serious consideration. So Marcy's point about worrying about enhancement, I think, is quite valid, and we need a big social conversation about enhancement in lots of different ways. I'm not sure that making germline modifications to change somebody's rare genetic variation that causes disease into the much more common variation that doesn't cause disease is all that worrisome. But right now, couldn't be done without FDA approval. FDA approval is nowhere close to being obtainable.
So I guess there's some solace then for those who are concerned.
Well, actually, this is Marcy, and I'd like to add to what Hank said there. It's true that many countries have prohibited this germline modification. You can't make genetic changes that are going to get passed on to future generations. And actually, it's more than 40 countries did that. And the reasons were because it was considered a violation of human rights, because the people who would be altered that way couldn't consent. it was thought to be introducing a new kind of eugenics. Mm-hmm. And so in deliberations that took place in the legislatures of more than 40 countries, there were laws, actual laws, put on the books. And in Europe, the Council of Europe actually drew up an international binding treaty that says the same thing. You can do gene editing to help people who are sick, and I would also support that if it's safe, if it's effective, if it's accessible, but you can't touch the human germline. So it's really important to know that that's really the international consensus.
So we're definitely treading on an area that people have debated some of these issues, but just we have a new technology now to apply it.
That's
it sounds
right.
Like.
And the report by the National Academies that Hank referred to in February was actually pretty shocking. The recommendation, and the National Academies, you know, it's an advisory group, it's not a government agency, but their recommendation that we might permit germline modification was a significant departure and a pretty surprising one. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem with it sounds reasonable to prevent the births of children with serious diseases, but there's a couple of really important points to know about the context of that. Mm-hmm. One, you don't need to be manipulating your future children's and future grandchildren and great-grandchildren's genes in order to prevent transmitting an inherited disease. There are other ways of doing that, including an embryo screening technology that's pretty conventional now, and that raises its own questions about selection, but that is less biologically risky and is less societally risky than germline gene editing would be.
Mm-hmm. So let me go to the phone lines, because we have Ed from Menlo Park who's been standing by, so I wanted to let him ask his questions, and then Marcy, if you have more you want to add, we can go back to you. So Ed, welcome to City Visions. What's your question for the panel tonight?
Yes, good evening. Thank you for this great program. I happen to have a very rare condition that's made me blind at this point. And what I'm wondering about is, I would be nervous about someone doing gene editing in my body. But if a adult cell could be taken from me, grown in a petri dish, and then gene editing done upon it, and it can be induced to be a pluripotent stem cell, and then those cells are introduced back into me to cure a condition, would that give me the opportunity to avoid having to take anti-rejection drugs and have a lasting benefit, or would the benefit be short-lived?
So thank you for that question, Ed. Sam, why don't I turn that one to you, because it sounds like it's a fairly technical question, but the other panelists may want to weigh in as well. But Sam, do you want to take the first crack at Ed's question?
Sure. And it's honestly probably too technical for me, because it's a little bit outside of my expertise. This is certainly something that is being pursued. You know, in terms of delivery, there's a lot of excitement about what Ed just mentioned, so an ex vivo therapy, ex vivo meaning done outside of living organisms, where you can actually remove the cells and edit them in the laboratory before transplanting the cells back into the patient. And the real advantage is that doing this in the laboratory, you can use a lot more rigorous quality control metrics to make sure that the edited cells are exactly as intended, rather than having to deliver CRISPR components into the body, which is often done using viral vectors, so something where you're basically repurposing viruses to deliver the components, and which comes with its own complications and challenges. So I don't want to speak any more specifically to the exact condition Ed talked about, because I wouldn't feel comfortable giving my thoughts since it's outside of my expertise, but certainly for diseases of the eye, certain kinds of blindness, this is definitely something being pursued, treating induced pluripotent stem cells with things like CRISPR or other gene editing technologies, and then transplanting them back into the patient.
Mm-hmm. And real quick, Dr. Darnofsky, do you want to weigh in as well?
Well, again, I think the distinction between helping people who have something going on in their body, a condition that they're trying to reverse, is really one thing, and then using it for future generations is really something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Ed, for that question and for dialing in. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing social, ethical, and regulatory implications of the CRISPR gene editing technology, and we're joined by Dr. Samuel H. Sternberg, biochemist, by Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, executive director at the Center for Genetics and Society, and by Hank Greeley with the Stanford School of Medicine. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join this conversation again is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. We have an email in from Ellen who asks, what may the impact be on people with disabilities? And I do not mean fixing or curing the disability, but what happens to people who have disabilities despite this technology? How does society view them or treat them? So, Marcy, why don't I let you answer that question? That sounds like something that you've thought about, given the impacts on humans and the ethics around it.
Well, yes, and Ellen is raising a really important point. If we get to the point where we are making distinctions between what's a good gene and what's a bad gene, we're getting into some tricky and often dangerous territory. And there are many people who are living very full, happy, thriving lives who have conditions that are considered disabilities, and they're not looking for a cure. They're looking for a way to live, to continue to live a good, full life and to have social support. So we make a distinction sometimes between the medical model and the social model of disability, and it's a tricky distinction between what counts as a serious disease that you want to cure and what's a disability that might just be, this is some one way of being human in the world. Mm-hmm. So we would not want to be getting ourselves into a new kind of high-tech eugenics, because that's exactly what we did in the last century, and people with disabilities were among the very early victims mm-hmm. of the 20th century eugenics movement. We certainly don't want to repeat those kinds of abuses and horrors. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so thank you, Ellen, for that question. Hank Greeley, I wanted to go back to you to something you had mentioned about bioterrorism. I'm curious if you can elaborate a bit on that and what the concerns are.
Sure. Although I'd like to first say a word about the disability issue, which I think is the hardest of all the equity and fairness issues, both in terms of telling people with some genetic diseases that, you know, implicitly society doesn't think their lives are worth living, but then more concretely in reducing the amount of research, reducing the medical knowledge about their disease and the impetus to learn more, reducing the social support. Those are really hard issues, and we need to be very careful not to let the disabled be victimized by this. On the other hand, I'm not comfortable telling parents, if you have a chance to avoid having a child with what many people consider a disability, you shouldn't be able to do it, because maybe that kid would grow up to think it's not a disability. I think it's a really hard, complicated question. Going back to the biowarfare issue, the good news is biowarfare is really hard. It's really complicated. You need more than just a disease. You need a delivery system, and you need a way to protect your own people. But CRISPR clearly makes the disease part of it easier. Just last week, there was an announcement about a group in Canada that created horsepox. Horsepox had been extinct. It was a pox disease that infected horses. They recreated the horsepox virus. What's really interesting here, though, is there are lots and lots of pox viruses out there, and one of the close relatives of the horsepox virus is the smallpox virus. So you could, in theory, take a horsepox or a monkeypox or a mousepox virus and use CRISPR to change it into a smallpox virus. That's scary.
So that's a good outline of the bioterrorism concern. I guess on the upside, you know, we hear about CRISPR being potentially able to help us address some of our environmental challenges. Can you, Hank Greeley, describe some of the potential environmental implications of CRISPR?
Sure. And, you know, like all technologies, it has potential downsides as well as potential upsides. But one of the one of the many interesting things is to use it to try to preserve and sustain endangered species. So, for example, the chestnut tree. Chestnut trees used to be a major part of the eastern North American forest. About 120 years ago, a fungus that was imported inadvertently started killing them all off. No chestnut trees, almost no chestnut trees now survive to adulthood. But you could make, and people already know how to do this, a relatively small genetic change to let the chestnut tree make a compound called oxalic acid, which protects it against this fungus. If you modified the chestnut trees and put it out in the wild, you could have chestnut trees back. That could be a big deal for the environment, not just for people who love chestnut trees, but for all the animals and other plants and microbes that grew up, that evolved in a chestnut environment. Another, of course, use is the use to try to change the environment to cut down carriers of human disease. People are trying to use CRISPR to cut down either the number of mosquitoes or, and this is the most ambitious one and really fascinating, make mosquitoes that cannot be infected with malaria. Because humans don't get malaria from humans, they get it from mosquitoes. 600,000 humans die every year from malaria, mostly in Africa. And if you could prevent the Anopheles mosquito from getting malaria, you could save almost all those lives. Would it work? Maybe. How would you test it? Hard to tell. Who would control it? If you start changing mosquitoes in, say, the Central African Republic, those mosquitoes don't know where the border is. They end up in Niger and Chad and the Democratic Republic of Congo and so on and may quickly spread all over the world. Who has the power to make those decisions? These are hard questions that we really need to confront soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And it reminds me of a lot of other environmental challenges that start to spill over borders, although, of course, this is obviously very technology dependent. We have an email from Ryan who asks, the wealthy already have so many advantages in our society. How would we ensure equitable distribution of this technology? How do we prevent the fast and strong getting faster and stronger? So, Marcy, this seems like a question for you. On the equity impacts here. So I want to give you a first crack at it.
Thanks. Yeah, and thanks for raising that, Ryan. I mean, for me, that's really the central question. I don't think, would be able to control that once we let germline engineering out into the world. I think you would quickly see it commercialized. These things are all patented. These techniques are patented. In fact, there are aggressive patent fights going on among the developers of CRISPR right now. And I think you could readily imagine that these technologies would be adopted into fertility clinics, which in this country and in some other countries are in the private sector. And, you know, you kind of see the ad copy writing itself. The parents would be told, you must act now before your child is born. This really is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And those who could afford it would purchase those upgrades for their kids, and even people who were uneasy about it might feel that they were obligated to do that. So I think you would see these kinds of commercial and competitive dynamics come into play, and we would quickly find ourselves in a world in which, in a sense, inequality was actually written into the genome. And again, even if some of these improved traits were more hypothetical than real, we know from lots of social science studies that children are treated differently by their teachers and their peers and their parents when they're thought to be to have higher IQs, say. So I think we would be setting ourselves up for a world of people who are thought to be the genetic haves and people who were considered the genetic have-nots. Mm-hmm. And we would be layering this other level of inequality and stratification onto the already shameful levels that we live with.
Dr. Sam Sternberg, I wanted to hear your take on that question. I'm sure you get asked that a lot. What are the equity implications of this technology? Is this going to make the rich richer? What do you usually say, or what are your thoughts on that line of thinking or questioning?
Yeah, I mean, as Marcy said, for me, this is one of my biggest challenges or, you know, things I grapple with CRISPR. And you can even look at gene therapy medicines, not even looking at germline gene therapy, but gene therapy drugs that are slowly starting to be commercialized for living patients, and these drugs often come with a price tag of about $1 million. And in fact, some companies, one of the companies that has commercialized the first gene therapy drug in Europe, chose in the last year or so not to pursue commercialization in the U.S. because they were concerned that it wasn't going to be worth it financially. So, you know, I think with any high-tech therapeutic, whether or not it's using the germline, it's going to challenge, you know, it's going to struggle with this challenge of how to make it equitable and accessible to people, not just those with the means to purchase it. I wanted to make one other comment to build off something Marcy was talking about. You know, I think with this issue of equity and these expensive treatments, you know, one thing I learned from reading Hank's book last year is that in vitro fertilization alone is already becoming rather prevalent in the U.S. So I think about 1.9% of births in the last year came about by in vitro fertilization. And as far as I understand it, the vast majority of IVF treatments are not covered by most health insurances. And so I think we already have this problem where certain couples are going to have access to IVF, whether it's as a result of fertility challenges or as a result of making decisions about when in life to have children and maybe relying on IVF because a mother or a father might want to wait until later in life to have children. So while, of course, this is going to be a major issue with CRISPR and any, you know, thought of germline editing, I think the reality is that we already have challenges with equity and existing reproductive technologies.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, Sam. We already have very enormous challenges. But if we add to that the fact that some children of the wealthy who can afford these editing techniques were going to be considered to be genetically superior, that's really a qualitative difference. And I think it's important also to say that, you know, this idea that you could use germline editing to, in the small number of cases where people know that they're at risk of passing on an inherited disease and they don't have an alternative, that idea that you could open the door just that little crack, I think that, and all those legislatures around the world think that you can't open this door just a crack. Once you do that, it's going to get blown wide open. Mm-hmm. And so
we don't lose much
by saying let's not touch the human germline. We can provide children who are unaffected and genetically related to their parents without using germline editing. So, you know, there's really not a good medical argument. There's not a good argument of any kind for it. And the societal risks are so dire that I think we should join all those other countries and just say, that's a no-go zone.
That's not quite true. There are some people, not very many, probably a few thousand couples around the world who cannot have a genetically related child through embryo selection, a technology that was the subject of my book and I think is a great technology. They can't use it because any child they have will necessarily get their genetic disease. That's not very many people, but those are people who can't have genetically related children without gene editing. And to say that we can't allow that exception without going all the way down is the classic slippery slope argument, but we live on slippery slopes all the time. That's our job as moral creatures, to figure out how far we'll go and no farther. And one last point, you keep talking about the consensus of nations. There are 200 countries. 40 have banned it. That means 160 haven't. I think the 40 deserve respect and consideration. But that's not a consensus.
So a lot of tricky policy issues here that we can get into in a moment. But first, I want to let listeners know this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're discussing the social, ethical, and regulatory implications of the CRISPR gene editing technology tonight. We're joined by Dr. Samuel Sternberg, a biochemist and co-author of A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution. Also by Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, the executive director at the Center for Genetics and Society, and finally by Hank Greeley, director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at the Stanford School of Medicine and author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. We do invite you to call in with questions or comments to hear your thoughts about genetically modified organisms and the other issues we've been talking about tonight. The number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if Feel free to email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website at kalw.org, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. We have an email from Thomas who asks, who should be regulating this technology? The Trump administration is waging a war on science. Congress is in a standstill. How are we going to keep this technology in check? Well, we've talked a little bit about that tonight, but Hank Greeley wanted to let you have a response to Thomas on that question.
Sure, and I think in the long run, that is a really important question. Getting good scientifically literate statutes out of Congress has never been easy, but it's probably never been harder than it is right now. Happily, the FDA currently has a powerful potential blocking role, and we have to work to keep that role there and to keep the FDA professional and relatively apolitical. But I think I do think we have time. We have 10 or 20 years, I suspect, before germline modification becomes safe enough to be clinically adopted, and probably several decades longer before serious enhancement germline modification becomes possible. We need to be talking about, thinking about, working on draft statutes, draft regulations, other things so that when the political stars are aligned properly, there are some good alternatives for Congress to adopt. But I do think in the long run, we will need congressional legislation. That scares me because I'm not confident Congress will do a good job. But we need to do what we can to increase the odds that Congress will eventually do a good job.
And what would you...
And that's true whether that good job is along the lines of what Marcy proposes or what the National Academies propose. Whatever your outcome is, getting a good piece of legislation to achieve that is really important.
And what would be your ideal public policy then, Hank?
So I think I would first continue to stress safety. On the human side, I think you can build off what the FDA already has. I would like to see a big debate and one that led ultimately to some legislative decisions about the enhancement versus medical line. Not an easy line to take, but I do think the biggest concerns about germline modification should be around enhancement and not around the relatively few medical uses. I think on the non-human side, we need to act much more quickly, and we need a regulatory statute that requires people who are modifying the genomes of living organisms to register, to tell people what they're doing, to be liable for the damages they cause, and most importantly, to have to undergo some sort of review before whatever they've made gets released into the environment.
And Dr. Darnofsky, what would you like to see from a policy perspective?
Well, let me make two points about that. First is that the Center for Genetics and Society and many, many scholars, and including scientists and biotech industry figures and all those other countries, do believe that we should prohibit human germline modification. For somatic gene editing, I hope that it comes to fruition. I hope that it can be used to help people who are sick, and I think we do have regulatory processes in place to look at safety and effectiveness. We don't, unfortunately, have policy processes that can make sure it's accessible, as Sam was talking about before. But the other point to make, I think, is that these technologies, as we've been talking about tonight, can change so much about our world. You know, they really can literally affect what organisms will exist and not exist. They can change entire ecosystems. They can literally reshape the human species. And with those kinds of potentials out there, I think we have to really see that this is not a question just for scientists and policymakers. These are questions that really demand widespread and extended public debate. And we have to listen to the voices of people who are going to be directly affected, but also to all of us. We've seen in our lifetimes how much technologies can reshape our personal lives, our communities, and our societies. Every one of us, has seen, for example, how information technologies can, and all of us know how much climate change could affect us. And so these are issues that all of us have a democratic responsibility and really a democratic right to weigh in on in a meaningful way.
So I wanted to ask about eugenics as well. I think, Marcy, you had mentioned this earlier in the show, but Dr. Sternberg, what is the potential for using this technology for high technology eugenics?
Well, maybe if I could first just comment. Well, I wanted to just comment on a couple of things that were just said.
Feel free to comment, and then you can go ahead and answer the question.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that CRISPR is really opening up a new door here, but, you know, we already have technologies that make decisions about what organisms should live or not live. I mean, people constantly make decisions about that with their own procreative choices, with abortion or with selective termination for embryos that are diagnosed with certain diseases. So I think it's also important to recognize that although CRISPR brings in new possibilities with making changes, I mean, in some senses, you know, we already have many of these powers and we use them in our day-to-day lives. And, you know, Hank mentioned gene-edited animals, but of course, we use selective breeding extensively and very aggressively. Just look at the diversity of dogs around the wild. I mean, that is not natural. That's something that humans had a very heavy hand in shaping over evolutionary time. So I think it's important to keep in mind that CRISPR isn't really creating problems that haven't already been seeing, you know, in areas in which humans have been heavily involved before gene editing technologies came about. With eugenics, I mean, again, this isn't really my area of expertise, but, you know, I think a distinction I see between eugenics as it's mentioned with gene editing technology today versus the, you know, horrendous eugenics movement of the early 20th century is that was really something that was state-run. And I think, you know, ensuring that the government does not make decisions for parents about what they will or will not do with their children, I think as long as you draw a very sharp boundary between procreative decision-making and the government, then you really avoid this risk that somehow there's going to be this global or kind of this widespread eugenics outcome from gene editing.
And Sam, I'd asked Hank earlier about the environmental impacts. I'm curious specifically on climate change. Do you see a potential impact on the climate change debate that would be potentially borne about by advances in this technology?
I mean, it's certainly feasible or foreseeable that gene editing and climate change could kind of dovetail in some ways in the future. And certainly, I didn't mean to minimize the impact that CRISPR could have on the environment. One thing we haven't really talked about much are gene drives, but Hank alluded to it earlier when he was discussing mosquitoes that might be engineered to be resistant to carrying the malaria parasite. So there are ways that CRISPR can be used that could really reshape the environment in a very pervasive way. Whether or not that's going to, you know, dovetail with climate change, I mean, I think I can't really comment on that right now.
I wonder if I could ask you a question. I agree with you that we have to be very careful about letting the government, keeping the government's hands off our procreative decisions, yes. But, you know, deciding whether to have a child and deciding what traits a future child could have, I think, are really different things. And I think we have to also, as we're looking at the potential for a new kind of eugenics, look not just at the power of governments, but also at the power of big business and corporations to set in motion the kinds of dynamics that we were talking about before that could set off a eugenics in effect, even though it would be consumer and market-based.
So let me ask each of you in turn what you see as the biggest challenges that still loom out there, whether it's technology, social, or regulatory. And Hank Greeley, why don't I start with you on that? What do you see as the biggest challenges on the horizon here?
Two things. First, get control over use of CRISPR and similar technologies in non-humans. Get a regulatory scheme that works well so that we know what's happening and we have some control over what's released. The second one on the human side, I think we do have some time there to take our time and come up with, have broad discussions, come up with broadly acceptable positions, both with respect to medical uses and with respect to enhancement uses, while always bearing in mind issues of equity, issues of access, financial viability, disability rights, et cetera.
And
so they're really two different issues, but they both deserve attention, but on somewhat different time frames.
Mm-hmm. And Marcy, same question for you. What do you see as the challenges that the biggest challenges that remain?
Well, our focus really is on the human applications. So for me, the challenge is to draw the line in a place where the line can be held, and that is between encouraging uses of gene editing that can help people who are sick and discouraging and prohibiting by law uses that would lead to a world of genetically enhanced children and future generations.
Mm-hmm. And same question for you, Sam. Challenges that you see remaining?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm really motivated and kind of impassioned to make this dream of curing diseases or treating diseases in a better way with gene editing a reality. And I think many other researchers are really pushing on somatic gene editing, on ways to improve the lives of patients living with disease. And one point I would want to end on for myself, you know, I think one thing we haven't touched much upon is that in the biological research community, CRISPR has completely transformed the way that scientists do research, and it's opened up doors that were never there before for scientists to really peer under the hood of biology and understand how our genome or how animals' genome makes them what they are. And so I think, you know, CRISPR has really allowed science to take off in a new way, and that's something that I'm also really excited about continuing in the future.
Well, that actually is my final question for each of you about what you see as the greatest potential positive outcome from this. What's the biggest hope you'd have for this? And I say,
sure,
I'll stay with you on that.
I can start. I mean, I can just, you know, repeat the same point I just made. I mean, you can just look in the news from a week ago. There was this insane article that came out of George Church's lab at Harvard where they used CRISPR, technically a kind of different version of CRISPR, but if we simplify it, they used CRISPR to write a GIF or a GIF for those of you that use a hard G, but to write a GIF into the genome of bacteria as a way of recording a short animation. And, you know, the kind of research advances being made are just phenomenal and are so exciting, and I think, you know, I really hope that the research community just keeps on rolling with all these discoveries and pushing these technologies to their extremes.
So we should look for those GIFs, but let me also let Hank and Marcy weigh in very quickly. Marcy, go to you. What do you see as the greatest hope here with this technology?
Well, I really share the hopes for advances in basic understanding of biology and also for curing people who have the kinds of conditions that will help be amenable to gene editing. And then I would also just add that I think that if we can get a handle on this as a society and really, you know, not fetishize the technology, but put the issues of social justice and equity at the center, I think it could lead us to a new way of understanding science.
Let me give Hank just one last final thought here. Hank, your greatest hope?
Better understanding of basic biology, which we can use to cure and prevent disease and to cure and improve the world's environment.
Great. Well, we're going to have to leave the discussion there, but I want to thank you all for this fascinating discussion. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Dr. Samuel H. Sternberg, biochemist and co-author of A Crack in Creation, Gene Editing and the Unthinkable Power to Control Evolution, Dr. Marcy Darnofsky, the executive director at the Center for Genetics and Society, and Hank Greeley, the director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at the Stanford School of Medicine and the author of The End of Sex and the Future of Human Reproduction. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. And for a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show is produced by Kendra Klang. Please join my co-host Joseph Pache next week at the same time, Monday night at 7 p.m. for another edition of City Visions. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.